Guys, welcome to another episode of Interview with an MVP. This episode is extremely interesting because we have a very special guest with us here today, Clint. We have my good friend, colleague, and former brother-in-law, Alan Rafuse, here with us. And so what we're going to be talking about today is Hyper-V operational training and what it takes to actually get yourself to a point where you can fully support Hyper-V in production beyond the training, beyond everything else. And guys, why is this important as you look to set up a virtual environment? So I guess we'll start with you, Clint. Like, where in your experience, having supported big virtualization farms, mm-hmm. why is this important? Why do we need to get ourselves ready?
Right. So, I mean, just, you know, getting the product installed is one part of it, but actually being able to use it functionally in a real live production environment. You know, there's a lot of training courses and books and things that you can go and read that provide very, how do I say this? Kind of
rudimentary
step by step. This is how you do this. This is how you do this. This is how you do this. Yeah. Right. But they don't really provide you with maybe a solid foundation or background of the product, understanding of it, of actually how it really works in a real live production environment. So this first part of the operational training that we're going to provide you with here is focused on, you know, just standalone Hyper-V. What is it? Yeah. How do I install it? How do I get it up and running? You know, and Alan, I'm going to throw this one over to you, okay. Is, you know, having managed large Hyper-V deployments and large environments, you know, in your experience, what do you see folks struggle with? You know, what are the areas that there might be room for improvement for a traditional IT administrator?
Well, I think most of them still think of the bare metal box. You have your basic CPU, memory, mm-hmm. and storage, but now you're sharing all that infrastructure inside a larger box,
right,
with other resources. So you have to kind of share it. You have contention that comes in. Mm-hmm. And now instead of having one box that you may have to back up, you may have hundreds of boxes that you need to back up. So the whole strategy that you're normally used to in a traditional server type environment has changed quite a lot over the last few years.
Right. I mean, that's just with virtualization in general.
For sure.
It's really kind of flipped the, you know, the whole paradigm of the way that things have been done in the past. And it's really been fun and interesting to be a part of technology just over the course of the last 10 years because, you know, Dave, we were racking and stacking physical servers. I can remember, you know, back whenever I was on that side of the fence, having to go down to the data center and put servers into the rack and install IIS or SQL Server and things like that.
Single standalone servers.
Now it's completely different. So the purpose of this first part is to provide the training that you need on, you know, installing Hyper-V. What is it? How do I get it up and running? And, you know.
Absolutely. Absolutely, guys. And so we really hope that you guys enjoy the training. I think right now we're up to about our 10th operational training mm-hmm. session, and I think we've got about 15 scheduled. So this is number one. And so this is really an introductory overview of, you know, the platform. And then the next ones that are coming up will actually dig in a bit deeper into some of the ancillary technology. So, guys, thanks a lot, and let's jump right into it. Sound good?
Awesome.
Sounds great.
All right. Welcome, everybody, to our Hyper-V and System Center operational training. I'm Dave Kuula, and I have a very special guest with us, a fellow Microsoft MVP and actual VMware vExpert, Clint Wyckoff. Clint and I speak at various conferences around the world together, and I asked him to join us for this training as a very special guest. So, Clint, very glad that you could actually join us here for these sessions that we're going to be running over the next few weeks here.
Awesome. Thanks for having me, Dale. I appreciate it.
No problem. So just a little bit of housekeeping for everybody. The goal of this training session that we're going to be going through here is to operationalize you and or your staff on Hyper-V and System Center. So we want to be able to turn over the Hyper-V projects that we're working on with you and your teams and make you guys feel comfortable driving in the similar fashion as to what you feel with your VMware environments, or if you're just new to virtualization, we want to get you fully up to speed. Clint, I told you not to put that picture in there. That's a top secret picture. That's not supposed to be released anywhere. All right.
And I see what Dave does in his spare time.
Exactly.
Exactly.
All right. Okay, you want to just advance there, Clint? I think there was a slide before that was your contact info and stuff like that. So Clint and I are very active on Twitter, guys. So one of your first housekeeping notes that you're going to have is if you guys aren't on Twitter, you need to get on Twitter. All right, even if you're not a big fan of social media, this is where you're going to find a lot of industry experts like Clint and myself hanging out, and we're very approachable in social media, even more so than email, because we get so many emails now on a daily basis, we tend to drift away from that, whereas we're typically very responsive in Twitter. So if you have questions or, you know, anything like that, feel free to reach out to us or, you know, follow us, because we typically post a lot of really important things. And for example, I think there was some new malware and stuff that just came out earlier this week, some pretty scary stuff. So that's normally where we'll be posting it first is, you know, inside of our Twitter streams. Clint, do you want to just give a quick overview of yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. So, hey, everybody. My name is Clint Wyckoff. As Dave mentioned, I am a MVP as well as a VXpert. I have an interesting background coming from retail here in the States. Spent about 8 or so years at Dick's Sporting Goods in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania as a VMware admin, where I ran and owned the virtualization practice there for the company. Today, I work as an evangelist on the Microsoft side of the fence. Definitely love being active and out in the community. As you can see here, I run a user group in Pittsburgh called VBrisket. So definitely active blogger as well as on Twitter. Check us out.
And if you guys are ever out at a lot of the industry conferences, you'll typically find Clint and I presenting there. And Clint, what exactly is that slide? What is that?
So really quick, and we'll get to business here, but Dave and Crystal run a roadshow called MVP Days. I'm sure you guys have all heard Dave talk about it. Earlier this year, we did a roadshow that started in Toronto, went to Ottawa, and then Montreal, and Dave and Crystal had the fantastic idea of renting a bus to drive us between all three of the cities. Unfortunately, whenever you rent a bus, you're subject to some failures, and one of those failures being blown tires. So you can see here, this is an actual picture of our bus. So we can always go back and look back on that story and say, you know, remember that one time on the bus ride to in Canada? Well, yeah, we had a huge flat tire. And then the bus actually blew up into a pile of flames, and we all had to rent clown cars in order for us to get to the event on time. So it was a fun story.
Two breakdowns in back-to-back days. A lot of fun. That was actually on our Eastern swing that we did of MVP days in Toronto, Ottawa, and Montreal. So, yeah, we had the pleasure of renting cars to go drive to Montreal. All right.
Yeah. Down to actually Dave out the back right here. You can
exactly.
See.
Yeah. Clint's somewhere in the middle there.
All right. Let's get to business.
Okay, so I know that most of the people that are on the call here today are currently on Windows Server 2012 R2, Clint, and or are looking at some System Center components in 2012 R2 and or are getting there. So they may or may not have all of those. Guys, one of the things that we're going to do for you during this session is we have tailored this to your current infrastructure that you have in 2012 R2, but we are going to make some references to Windows Server 2016 and some of the new updates that you're going to be seeing. It is pretty common knowledge now that Microsoft is going to be releasing the GA version, the general availability version of Windows Server 2016 at their Microsoft Ignite conference coming up here in September of this month, actually in a few weeks. So I think in your roadmaps, you have to start thinking about when you're going to be integrating 2016 into your data centers. For some of you, you don't like to be on the leading and bleeding edge of this, and that's fine. I completely agree with that approach. But I think sometime within the next year or so, you'll be looking at some type of a migration over to 2016. So what we're going to do is we're going to focus the session on what you have today on 2012 R2 and this series. And then at the end, what we'll do is Clint and I have an upgrade module where we'll talk about all the new things that are coming in 2016.
we've been speaking kind of primarily about Windows Server 2016. But what's going to end up happening is it's going to take and it's going to be coming really soon for you. So Clint, why don't we get started here?
Yep.
All right. Do you want to just walk through the introductory modules there real quick?
Yeah. So as Dave mentioned, right, the first we're going to focus on a couple of different areas, and the way that we've tailored this course is to be kind of a introduction, right, which is what we're going to be talking about today, and then quickly getting more and more advanced, right? So you can see today we're going to focus on the virtualization components and host configuration. Then we're going to get into clustering, configuration, network virtualization, and then advance into more of the system center type components with virtual machine manager, as well as how they focus on managing, you know, the hybrid cloud from, you know, multi-hypervisors and things from that perspective. And then always trying to make it relate back to, you know, what you're familiar with on the VMware side of the fence. Because, you know, having come from that kind of persona, having managed a VMware environment, but also being well familiar of what Hyper-V has to bring to the fence. So, you know, just kind of relating things so that you can operationalize and feel a lot more comfortable with Hyper-V in your guys' environment. So the first place that we're going to start, very, very basic, right? So 101 type stuff. We're not going to get too terribly advanced just quite yet, to making sure that you guys have a solid understanding of what the different types of technologies that are out there today, right? So, and this just kind of relates, as you can see here, what VMware offers in the right-hand column, right? So you're familiar with the hypervisor being vSphere. The way that you manage VMware virtual machines is Virtual Center. If you wanted to do any type of self-service or any type of infrastructure as a service or multi-tenancy type deployments, right? vCloud Director is the way that you go. If you wanted to do monitoring, right? Everybody's familiar with vRealize and the vRealize suite, vSphere Data Protection. Well, Microsoft has offerings that cover all of those components as well, right? So Hyper-V being the main hypervisor, Virtual Machine Manager or VMM kind of being the single point of reference inside of System Center that you can use to manage large groups of Hyper-V nodes. You can use the standalone Hyper-V Manager, or you can use the System Center component, which is VMM. And then Operations Manager, which is the old SCOM, System Center Operations Manager, DPM. And then they have Service Manager as well for like ITIL type incident problem change management related tasks and activities. So you can see how you can connect the dots between what you're familiar with from a management perspective inside of the VMware ecosystem to what Microsoft has. And I think the best way that you can kind of relate these two together is System Center is essentially equivalent to the vCloud suite or vRealize suite that VMware has to offer. And then here we can see, you know, just some of the different licensing. So the way that you're all familiar with how VMware is licensed, and Microsoft is typically licensed very, very similar per se. You know, I think the key item of note here is you're already purchasing the data center edition of the Windows operating system, right? So that gives you the ability to run unlimited OSCs or operating system environments inside of your ecosystem there, right? So Hyper-V is a layer of that, and it comes for free. So essentially, once you own the data center license, you can run as many instances of Windows on that license as you'd like. Anything to add to there, Dave?
No, I think you're right, and I think most of the customers that I've got on here, they will be licensing inside of that data center suite licensing, and a good portion of them will have subscribed with Software Assurance in the data center, so have the entire System Center suite. We do have a balance of some that buy open licenses, so they won't have access to all the System Center components, but the goal is just to level up some of that skill set, because pretty much everybody's going to be getting there. Cool. All right, and I'm not going to worry about getting into pricing discussions and stuff like that around this. Just more some informational stuff for everybody. All right. So some Hyper-V deployment options that you have. So we've seen a variety of different deployment approaches across our customer base. And so the believe it or not, the most typical way still of deploying Windows servers from what I've found is, you know, take the ISO, pop it in. If you're dealing with HP servers, for example, you'll take and you'll probably use the bootstrappers that come with HP using their automated build tools so that you can get all the drivers and everything built. And most of the vendors have a kind of customized process for building these things out. So the initial way of deploying this is, you know, you pop in the ISO, you mount the media, you're just going to build that that server. Hyper-V is actually just a role that runs with inside Windows Server. And I think one of the really important things to note is that Microsoft inside of their ecosystem has done a really good job of standardizing that hypervisor platform. So it actually doesn't matter what Hyper-V hypervisor you're on, as long as you're still in the same version class, they're all technically speaking identical. So for example, if you had a Windows 8.1 laptop, you can actually install the Hyper-V role on that laptop as long as it supports it. You can then take and migrate those workloads off of your laptop into your server data center. The actual core components of the kernel in regards to Hyper-V are identical from both the desktop version and the server version. So in respect to Windows 10, if you had a Windows 10 laptop, you could actually live migrate your workloads off that Windows 10 laptop into a Windows Server 2016 farm, and you could actually do that without downtime. So that's pretty cool. All right, so what are some of the other deployment options that we have, Clint? I find that, like I said, most are going to take and actually deploy with the GUI, and this is actually a good spot for a question for everybody that we've got on the call. What do you guys deploy in your organization today? Do you guys deploy Windows Server with the full GUI? Or are you guys fans of Server Core? And if you don't know what Server Core is where we actually have stripped down components inside the kernel. And this was kind of Microsoft's first real crack at having a skinny operating system, less attack surface, less patches, stuff like that. I know for me, I'm a Windows clicker through and through. But you know what? I'm actually really starting to look at the newest version of Server Core, which is going to be coming with Server 2016, which is called Nano Server. So we can, Clint and I can point you in the right direction to some of that stuff, but I'm curious. So we got a couple people coming in here, Clint. I see that that Chad's saying that they're running full GUI. Zach is saying that they're full GUI, but they're looking at Core right now. And then go ahead, Clint. Yeah.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, I think traditionally, yeah, the full GUI is the easiest way to go. Everybody likes to go in and control, delete and click around, but definitely try to force yourself. And this is something that I've done in labs and things, not in my production Hyper-V deployments, just because everybody likes to have a GUI to get around and, right, it makes things a lot easier. But I've forced myself, at least in my lab infrastructure, to use the Core version. And I'm a big proponent of, and I love what Nano Server brings to the table, as Dave said, but we can talk about those during later sessions. But Core Nano is great for large scripted administration and smaller environments. It's faster to click through the GUI. I completely, completely agree with you there, Chad. Absolutely.
I think Chad had one other question in there too. Do you find most customers use Hyper-V Manager or System Center together or one over the other? You know what? It really depends on the environment. I find that it really depends on if the customer's got entitlements for System Center. So if they already kind of own that System Center suite, then I find that they're going to take and they're going to be very interested in using all those components they've already paid for. If not, I have a lot of customers that actually just manage straight through the native UI and management tools. They actually stay completely away from System Center. So it's kind of a mixed bag there, guys.
For sure.
All right. So some of the other deployment options that you have, I've actually built a few custom deployment solutions for some of our customers right now, where we've actually used a Microsoft deployment toolkit to roll out those deployments in a more automated fashion. And I don't know if you guys that are on the call today know that there's actually a free version of Hyper-V Server. It's a standalone download and installer, and it is the real version of Hyper-V. This version of the regular old Hyper-V Server does not include any Windows Server licenses and is very, very popular in hosting environments where they're going to be running, like, for example, a lot of Linux workloads that actually don't require licensing components. So it's a completely free server-based virtualization solution. And it's actually the same kernel.
It's absolutely the same. I like to keep relating back to vSphere, right? So some of the things that VMware does is they lock down specific APIs within the free version of vSphere. Microsoft doesn't do that. The only thing that they limit is the fact that you need to license each of the operating systems, if it's Windows or if it's Linux, depending on which distribution of Linux and what the licensing agreement that provides depends on how those would be licensed. But just something to note there for you guys.
All right. Good stuff, guys. And yeah, I'm seeing that probably most everybody's using server GUI right now. And I think the first place they'll be looking at a skinny down version will probably be Nano for Server 2016. Okay, so the timelines and life cycle of Hyper-V here, it's actually really interesting, Clint, because I've got some of my clients that are on the call here today that actually we started virtualizing with Server 2008 and Server 2008 R2, and they've actually walked through pretty much every single version of Hyper-V that we've had, which is really cool to me. And Microsoft, in my opinion, didn't really start adding what I would call enterprise-grade features until the October release of Hyper-V of Server 2008 R2, where we had the capability of doing live migrations, right? So that was kind of the first big one for me, having the ability to do that stuff. And then as they moved along, they started adding support for dynamic memory, you know, ballooning is the equivalent in VMware, and remote FX, which was, you know, graphics drivers pass-through, like the actual GPU pass-through capabilities. And all of these core features have just been getting added on by Microsoft as they've gone through. A lot of people have asked me in the past, Clint, why doesn't Microsoft add more of the features that we're looking for early on in the game? Like, for example, 2012 R2 came out. Microsoft actually had plans to add a lot more features into Hyper-V, but the problem is that they have to look at supporting the masses, and I call it an 80-20 rule. So they can only support 80% of the mainstream features with their platform support teams at a given point in time. So the other 20% that's inside of the wish list typically waits for the next versions, the R releases, R1, R2, and so on, which typically come out a year later. And so this has been the approach that I've seen Microsoft take all the way back from 2008. So they've got a lot of stuff on the roadmap and the drawing board, but they're kind of a little bit slow and patient to implement this stuff. All right. September 2016 coming as well. So this is just a slide on just some of the scalability. I had some questions when I was rolling around some of the client sites of, you know, what are the scalability, what's the scalability of 2012 R2? And this is basically just a slide for you to show you what's available. You can have up to 64 virtual CPUs, a terabyte of virtual memory. I don't even want to get into what 2016 is going to give you guys because it blows these numbers absolutely out of the water. We can dig up another slide for you guys, but like some of these are times six for the amount of what you can do. Like the amount of physical memory, I think was what, 20 some terabytes now, Clint, in 2016?
Yeah, I'd have to go back and look at the email that Ben sent out to us on the MVP DLs. But so here you can see just a quick chart for you guys to kind of compare. Now this is something that the traditional VMware fanboys, if you will, right, always love to say, well, VMware can do X, Y, and Z, Hyper-V can't, kind of thing. And there still are limitations, even in 2012 R2. You know, you got to power down a virtual machine if you want to add a NIC. You have to power down a virtual machine if you want to increase the memory, CPUs, things like that, hot add capabilities. there are some limitations, but, you know, as Dave said, you know, Microsoft's continually trying to increase the, raise the bar and really create, you know, a solution that fits not only the SMB environment, but also large, massive enterprise infrastructures and even service providers too. So definitely something that Microsoft's consistently working on. And you can see here, won't read them off for you, just some quick comparisons for you guys so you have the numbers if you ever wanted to go back and reference.
And if you guys ever decide, if any of you guys ever decide to buy hosts with 4 or more terabytes of RAM, Clint and I are more than happy to come over and help configure those and stress test them for you.
Yeah.
All right. So some of your virtualization management that you have. So this is where we first start to step into the System Center suite. So this is probably a good time for another question for our participants that we have. How many of you are currently using System Center Virtual Machine Manager and or are planning on using it? Versus the native management tools that are out there today. And as you guys are typing in your responses, just a couple of scalability notes for you. Hosters have typically run into problems with a maximum of 1,000 Hyper-V hosts and 25,000 virtual machines. And nobody that's on the call today is going to actually run into these issues. One of the most underused features I find that comes with System Center Virtual Machine Manager, Clint, is the fabric management components. And those fabric management components actually allow us to build out our virtual networking stack. They allow us to build out our storage stack and manage all of that through a single pane of glass. So we can, you know, do all of our VLAN management. We can do all of our storage management. We can manage all of those pieces right from Virtual Machine Manager. And some of the guys over at Teravita right now, I built a custom deployment solution for them using the Microsoft Deployment Toolkit. We could actually take that same process that I built using MDT, and we could actually build that right into Virtual Machine Manager. You can actually deploy bare metal servers over the IPMI, which is also known as ILO, in HP terms, or it's known as a DRAC for Dell. It's just the out-of-band management. You can attach to that out-of-band management network port, and you can actually bare metal deploy servers, your host servers, in a completely standardized fashion through VMM. Now, it sounds really nice to be able to do that. I find that hosters are normally the ones that are using that more often than not. Most of my server teams are still using standard operating environment build documents that they would follow to build their hosts. So just understand that VMM does have that capability. It's just one of those pieces that I find not a lot of people are actually using today. And this is going to be kind of your comparison for vCenter.
Yeah, absolutely. Center might be a little bit easier to use, and for a couple of you guys out there, it looks like, you know, Carl's currently using VMM, and Teravita, the server team there, is planning on using VMM. So you'll notice it's a little bit different than what you're used to using with vCenter, but essentially it provides a lot of the same functionality that vCenter server does today.
Right? Yeah, for sure.
And here you can see.
Go ahead, Clint. I'm just going to be right back in 2 seconds. You can carry on.
Okay. So no, I was just going to point out here, you know, so VMM has a lot of the same architecture as what vCenter does. You know, it's got a back-end SQL database. You know, you can see down here on the bottom left-hand side, it can manage up to 1,000 hosts per management server. And there's even a management console that you use to connect to, and that can be installed either on a server or on a workstation as well, if you had perhaps wanted to install it on your laptop. And then if you wanted to extend that out into App Controller as well, is another component of System Center. And then even if you wanted to make a highly available VMM infrastructure, and I would probably venture to say that nobody on this call would probably be set up in this type of deployment method. You know, that's just really comparable where you need some level of high availability from a management perspective.
It is possible to cluster it. So if any of you guys need to cluster your VMM servers, it does support. So we can change the configuration. I don't find very many people go down that road. It just adds kind of unnecessary complexity, just because you're always going to have the ability to go back to the native management tools and UI under the covers. So even if that stops working, things aren't just going to totally fall apart.
Correct. So let's see here. What do we have? Just kind of another visualization of the way that you can plug in the different System Center components, right? So on the right-hand side, Operations Manager. Curious, is anybody using SCOM, Microsoft System Center Operations Manager? You know, Service Manager is another component of it. It might be familiar with like BMC Remedy or Heat, other tools out there. Service Manager is very similar to those. Orchestrator, this is the old Opalis tool that Microsoft purchased a few years back. And then DPM or Data Protection Manager, which is their, we use SCOM 2012 R2. Awesome, Terravita. Actually, whenever I was at Dix, we were a System Center Operations Manager shop as well.
So there's something that we can actually extend. So if you guys in your environments today have SCOM deployed and or are using it, and you have it set up in kind of a reliable fashion, basically there's an additional feature inside of Virtual Machine Manager called Pro. And what Pro does is we can actually integrate at the hardware level via SCOM integration and SCOM alert. So basically, if you're having some type of catastrophic hardware failure on one of your HP servers, and we've detected, you know, a dead RAID card, or something's happening where we've dropped a drive, or a fan is blown, and, you know, CPU is going, RAM's going, whatever it is, what can happen is via that SCOM alert, we can actually start triggering data center automation functions via Pro, and we can start draining those roles off. So we can start draining all those VMs off that host that's potentially failing, and that's really cool. But one of the prerequisites for that is actually having SCOM set up, and it's actually really easy to integrate Pro as long as you have that SCOM environment built. So those of you that are on the call that are using SCOM, then we want to be having a sidebar conversation about, you know, what are the benefits of configuring Pro through VMM, because it really does integrate those two pieces really nicely and tightly together. One of the other big pieces inside of that System Center suite is Data Center Data Protection Manager. I actually do have a couple customers on the call here today that are actually using DPM. It does come as part of that suite. And so if you are planning on, you know, using that and moving forward with that, there's some good hooks that we have there as well for, you know, being able to fully back up and protect those workloads. I know in today's economy that we have, you know, we try to use the native tools that we have that we've already paid for as much as possible. And so, you know, that could make a bit of sense there as well. The other little note that I have here is that the app controller piece in VMM is deprecated right now. So it's going away, or it's going to be gone for 2016. It's replaced with a bunch of like Azure automation functions. And same thing with Orchestrator. I'm finding that a lot of the runbook automation pieces are actually starting to come out of split hybrid environments between Azure and your private cloud data centers and your private data centers that you guys are running. All right, you want to go to the next one there, Clint?
Yep. Let's see here, what we got up next? Host configuration. So there's a couple of different ways, right, that you can configure your Hyper-V host, right? Probably the first one that you're most familiar with is, you know, deploying on the left-hand side here, right, from DVD or ISO, right? So this is where you would use, say, for instance, the DRAC or ILO to remotely mount the ISO image, boot up the bare metal piece of hardware, install Windows Server on it, enable the Hyper-V role, so on and so forth, right? One of the other methodologies here you can see in the center is create, you know, USB Pixie boot. If you wanted to use that, is the right-hand side here, so you can Pixie boot those. And I think, Dave, you actually have a couple of customers, right, that you had set up using the network deployment methodology with Hyper-V, with HP blades, right, or rack mount servers.
Yep, yeah, for sure. And the other thing we've got is we've got a kind of a hybrid custom solution that we built for a few of them using MDT as well. It's just because you go with what you have experience and flavor with. And I had the pleasure of actually writing an SCCM and MDT book about a year and a little bit ago, and you know, did a lot of work with, you know, automating and zero touch deployments. And so it just takes a little bit of extra time to build some of those pieces out, and it really kind of depends on how many hosts you have as well.
And then again, always connecting the dots back to what VMware has to offer, right? So deployment from DVD, USB, stateful deployments, stateless deployments. If you wanted to have those, you know, every time your VMware host rebooted, it would automatically reprovision ESX on it. That's something that is offered via a tool they call AutoDeploy. That's just something to note here, that's not available within Hyper-V today.
Awesome. So when you take a look at some of the actual host configuration options that you have, basically this screen that you're looking at is what you're going to see if you were to right click on one of your hosts that you would have inside of the Virtual Machine Manager console. And so inside of there, you're going to have settings to configure your hardware settings, your storage settings, your virtual switches, and, you know, migration settings. I do have a question for the group right now. Those of you that are using VMM right now today, are you using any of this, the storage administration function, LUN control, stuff like that out of VMM, or do you do that as a sidecar action? Do you just let your storage guys take care of that? Or you envision yourself, even in the future, extending that control and allowing VMM to hook into those paths? Because I find this is a real mixed bag, Clint, where our storage guys mm-hmm. want to keep looking after that stuff, and they're not necessarily going to feel comfortable releasing control over some of those pieces. VMM does have the capabilities of extending into, you know, the network infrastructure and hardware, so...
Hosts and storage. Dun, dun, dun. Very popular topic. So let's play this out. So, all right. A couple of different ways, right? So you can have your Hyper-V nodes hosted on iSCSI or Fibre Channel. Now, this would be like a cluster shared volume. Or if it wasn't part of a Windows failover cluster, it can be, say, for instance, direct attached storage or even a remote SAN if you have that option available. Multipath I/O support, right? So full support if you wanted to, or you should install the multipathing drivers from, say, for instance, your network card vendor or from your HP or HBA vendor. Dave, you want to talk about ODX and the native 4K disk support there?
Yeah, for sure. So some of your SANs that you guys have are going to support something called ODX. So ODX is the acronym for offload data transfer. And so basically what can end up happening is if you guys can envision copying a file over the network by just using a UNC path, you know, /// server A to server B, or just moving files around on your subsystem, you have to do a lot of work on the local host machine that you're copying from to temp up and queue up those file transfers, and then it has to proceed over the network. What ODX does is it actually offloads all of those transfers directly onto the SAN itself. And so, for example, you can envision cloning operations where, you know, we want to spin up a VM from, you know, maybe a template, or we want to spin up some VDI instances or something like that. If your SAN does support ODX, all of those operations are basically passed off to the SAN via API calls, and all of those copy operations stay local on that device. So it never actually has to traverse or cross the network. And so the benefit of that is you're going to take and have immensely faster jobs and operations instead of having to have everything proceed across the network. Now, here's where a reality check comes in for, you know, everybody that's on the call. So I have two different ways that I look at these things. I look at the, you know, the Microsoft pitch on some of this stuff, and then I look at, you know, the reality of what actually happens. ODX has had a lot of issues with specific SAN vendors where, you know, it's actually caused problems in the environments, and we've actually had to turn off that feature more often than not. I know I've had a couple of my customers running NetApp SANs. It just wasn't working properly, and it was causing us issues, and we actually had to disable it. Now, the vendors are going to come out with patches and hotfixes and do what they need to do to make some of these features work. And in theory, it's a good thing. ODX is a good thing to have, but it also needs to be fully supported, functional, and working properly. So that's kind of my two cents on ODX. And then the 4K disk is just kind of your block write sizes that you have for being able to write in. And it does compare with some of the VMware features here.
Yep. One of the things that I guess I should have highlighted as part of the multipathing, now there is a role within Windows Server itself that you can enable that Microsoft has natively built in there that provides native multipathing out of the operating system that existing storage vendors, their drivers plug into that multipathing and really further that and enhance it specific to their individual storage array or their individual HBA cards depending upon how you're configured there.
Yeah, and I'm just writing a note in the chat to everyone. You want to make sure that when you take and you're working with Fibre Channel specifically, and even some of the iSCSI SANs are still out there today, make sure that you're getting your DSMs. I forget what the acronym is for that, but your DSMs are basically going to be the vendor-specific multi-path drivers and applications for that particular HBA or card. You want to get that as a vendor-specific thing and make sure that you keep those up to date, all right? The last thing is firmware and driver patch levels that you have inside of these farms. I get a lot of calls in regards to Hyper-V storage flapping, going up and down and having issues. And where I normally find the issues come is it's actually not even a Hyper-V problem. It's not a Windows Server problem. It's the fact that I've got HBA firmware revision X on the first node, and I've got a different revision on the second node, and I've got a different revision on the third node. Make sure you stay consistent on these things, okay? Hyper-V servers should be treated node differently than as if you're building a farm of web servers. You want to make sure that those are absolutely identical. Every single one of them is identical, from the patch levels in Windows to the drivers to the HBA drivers to the firmware, everything. Make sure that you guys stay consistent on that stuff. Upgrade one, you want to have a plan to upgrade them all.
Yeah, and I've actually been burnt in the past in previous life. Now, this wasn't in a Hyper-V farm. It was in a VMware farm where the storage guys actually did a firmware update on the we had an IBM SVC. They updated the SVC code, and they didn't inform us, being the server team, what was going on. And we had multipathing drivers and firmware versions and all that stuff that was mismatched. So we had data stores and things going offline. We were doing boot from SAN, so a lot of our physical machines blades were having problems as well from this mismatch because they didn't check the hardware compatibility lists and notify us before they did their upgrade. So not to put fear in there, but it's kind of one of the obvious things that definitely folks typically overlook, right, is making sure that your patch levels are up to date. Make sure that your firmware levels, your drivers from a hardware perspective are up to date. Yep. And as Dave says there, save yourself the pain.
All right. What's next for us? Oh yeah, I think this is just getting in through some of the SMIS and SMP providers and some of these pieces. So if you guys do want to look at some of the automation pieces, for example, let's say that you wanted to carve out a new cluster shared volume or something like that off of your SAN, and you wanted all of those pieces to happen automatically through Virtual Machine Manager, and you didn't want to have to keep integrating and talking to your storage guys to carve you off the LUNs and present everything and go through their separate UIs, those APIs available actually hook into a lot of common storage vendors that are out there. So if you want to check with your storage appliance that you have, there's basically two big ways that you can see if it's going to be supported by VMM, and that's number one through SMIS or through SMP. All right. So this would just be the configuration of this. I know some of you guys have looked at this. Anybody doing this today that's using VMM? Anybody using SMIS or SMP providers? I know that a lot of your SANs probably support this, but just pop into the chat window if you are. I'm just curious.
If they're using like remote SMB3 shares, like say for instance, I know one storage vendor out there, Tintri, for instance, right? They hook into all the Hyper-V node to provide storage over SMB3 share, and they use the SMIS and WMI protocols to communicate with the Hyper-V nodes. Doesn't look like anybody is.
A couple of the customers that I'm working with right now are just in the process of deploying VMM for them right now, so they may not have made that decision yet.
Right.
Basically, if your SAN's going to support this, your SMP providers will actually just show up inside of there. I've done this on a couple different SANs, and I've got lots of demos online of me hooking an SMP through various storage vendors and through VMM, and it's pretty straightforward. Basically, all that you have to do is you just have to have access to the SAN from the VMM server, and then basically you can take and you can carve out different tiers of storage based on that. And configurations of iSCSI through here as well. I'm pretty sure that most of my customers that I've got on here, Clint, are probably going to carve out most of their storage manually for their environments and their servers. Just know that VMM does support it. So if you guys did want to extend or kind of expand those capabilities down the road, it is there and it is available for you via VMM.
It is, and the reason why that Microsoft provides this is to help with the automation story of, you know, the hybrid cloud where, you know, services come online, expand, contract dynamically, being able to have these hooks in there to tie into your storage to automatically provision and deprovision storage on the fly. That's kind of the use case of what VMM is set out to fix and solve.
Perfect. Some fiber channel integration. This is an interesting one because we actually had some questions coming across our MVP emails. So Clint and I are part of a distribution list that actually hooks right into the product team to Microsoft, and it's our MVP Hyper-V distribution list. And one of the questions that came across there was, is anybody actually using what are called virtual HBAs, virtual fiber channel adapters, basically, because they are supported inside of Hyper-V. The closest representation I would have to this, Clint, in managing at that particular level in Hyper-V would be something called a raw device mapping or an RDM inside of VMware. We can now have that similar type capability inside of Hyper-V by taking and passing through that LUN directly to a guest from a fiber channel SAN. Now, the problem in doing this in today's day and age is the way that most of the backup applications run, they like to take what are called VSS snapshots. And those VSS snapshots typically can't touch a directly passed through LUN or iSCSI target directly on those VMs. So a better course of action that I found in designing this now for most of my customers anyway, Clint, is we'll typically just create additional VHDX files and we'll work on things that way instead of directly connecting to that fiber channel fabric straight into the virtual machines themselves.
Well, it's an old way of doing things. It's like using the in-guest iSCSI initiator to connect to an iSCSI share remotely, right? Why not virtualize it? You get the benefit, all the great benefits that virtualization, you know, brings to the fence.
You can keep going. I'm just making a few notes for people.
Let's see here. Yeah, so here you can just essentially see what the steps are that you would want to go through and use if you were going to kind of try to take benefit of using the virtualized either iSCSI or fiber channel cards inside of a guest virtual machine, right? Yeah.
And just
add target ports down. Once connected, VMM can create, assign LANs, initialize disk, create partitions, volumes, etc., right? Completely automated.
And I just want to be clear on one thing. What I'm talking about is actually inside the virtual machine itself. Doing this level of automation through VMM and actually creating those partitions, CSVs, those volumes that you're going to be creating, that's fully supported. That doesn't break anything. That will work. I'm just saying you don't want to use the virtual fiber channel adapters because most people don't anymore. It's mostly there just for legacy capabilities. All right. So we have kind of a few different skill sets and roles on the call today. So we wanted to throw in a quick slide in here, just kind of deconstructing ASAN and just to make sure that everybody actually understands how these things typically work. Inside of your SAN, you've got physical disks. A lot of the new SANs that are coming out today are going to be a combination of either hybrid flash, all flash. Spinning disk, in my opinion, is dying. You'll see pretty much all flash in the data centers in the coming years if you're not already there. Typically those, go ahead.
Some of the more modern ones real quick, Dave, are even starting to expand out on the flash and use NVMe flash where you're going to even much, much, much greater performance than a traditional even, enterprise level or even commercial grade SSD hard disk.
For sure, for sure. And for those of you that are taking using solid state in your data center today, I would hazard to say you're not seeing nearly the number of drive failures that you were with physical disks. You know, I've got customers that have been running solid state inside of their data centers for, you know, the better part of 4 or 5 years. And those things are just, they just tick along. And we just don't see the same type of issues that we see with, you know, the life of those drives starting to, you know, depreciate after, you know, 3 years, 4 years. Things will start to pop really fast, right? So typically in those SANs, you've got controllers, and then you've got connectivity adapters with iSCSI, fiber channel over Ethernet, NSF, or NFS, SMB, SMB3, SIFs. They've got different type of connectivity that they'll take and provide on the back end. Now, the SAN technology, interestingly enough, is changing for most vendors. Because there's a new thing that's come out called hyperconverged infrastructure, where you're kind of blending that SAN and everything together. And Microsoft has actually really bitten off on this as well. And so Microsoft's version of this storage management is something called Storage Spaces in Windows Server 2012 R2. And what you could do with Server 2012 R2 is you could take and you could buy shelves of JBOD disks. Now, if you don't know what JBOD is, the acronym for that, it's really complicated. It's just a bunch of disks. And so basically, it would just be a shelf running disks, very low complexity, could be a mixed bag of SSD and spinning disks, and they would connect via SAS ports back up to your physical servers. Then what we could do is we could pool these together in what was called a storage space. So if you advance that, Clint, for me.
Sorry, I was reading something else.
Yeah, no problem. And so this introduction of storage spaces provided some very interesting capabilities for us with Microsoft environments, because basically what we could do is we could take these low-cost, low-complexity solutions, and you could kind of have a DIY infrastructure that you could build. And it had support for mirroring or parity stripes. You could actually have different lanes that you could have that you would build inside of there. And a lot of hosters love this because they were in full control over their environments. They weren't reliant on the SAN vendors anymore. Now what's happened with connectivity is that Microsoft has fully supported connectivity to this via RDMA adapters, iSCSI, SMB3. They've got some great options for actually connecting into these frameworks. Now, what they've done in Server 2016 is they've taken this to the next level. Instead of you just being able to take that single server that's attached to the shelf of disks, now we can take multiples of those and we can configure our own hyper-converged infrastructure. And that is called Storage Spaces Direct. However, you will need to have Windows Server 2016 in order to leverage that.
Yep. And you'll hear Microsoft reference, you know, Storage Spaces Classic, and then there's the new Windows Server 2016, which is Storage Spaces Direct, which requires at least four nodes to be part of. It uses the REFS file system format on the virtual disks and the storage pools that you create. And this is actually something that I've been playing with in a lab environment that I have access to. So,
very cool.
And then here's just some of the different benefits that is provided. Storage spaces, you know, one of the cool things here is you can see, you know, storage tiering. So you can create fast pulls and slow pulls of disk based on, you know, what type of SAN you have and where the data lives. However, kind of the cool thing that Windows Server 2016 brings to the fence and Storage Spaces Direct is automatic tiering of that data across multiple nodes. And it requires a shared nothing SAN infrastructure, right? So it uses Windows clustering and witness disks to essentially keep the cluster quorum active. So depending on which nodes of the cluster are currently owning VMs and own the storage, you know, those disks and those the data flow will automatically be tiered across all nodes of the cluster, right? So it's really cool answer to, you know, hyper-converged, just kind of know what's available today within Windows Server 2012 R2 that Dave was just talking about, and there's definitely a future there that Microsoft is going down with Windows Server 2016 and Storage Spaces Direct. So definitely some things you should keep your ear to the ground on there.
I think this was just a walkthrough of Storage Spaces Direct. You just take those DAS disks, convert them into pools, turn them into spaces, and then you create volumes underneath the covers. Now, guys, one of the things I have to mention with having Microsoft as your vendor for your storage, there are actually a lot of benefits to this. And some of the benefits that I really like is that I have a single throat to choke if something goes wrong with my infrastructure. I don't have to go get my SAN vendor involved. Now, this isn't for everybody. Some of you guys may want to take and you may want to continue working with your SAN vendors and your storage vendors, and that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But understand that there is a pure Microsoft play and a pure Microsoft solution in here as well. All right. So I think Clint has to leave us in about 2 minutes or so. But I'm going to carry on here for about another half an hour with this session. So what I have to do is I actually have to steal back presentation rights here. So just give me a sec. If you guys have any questions for Clint, even after he's gone, just feel free to fire away in the chat, because we'll be coming back to that as part of a kind of master transcript for the sessions that we're running here for you guys. So let me see if I can take back presentation rights here.
Here, I'll just give it to you. Go like this. See here, Dave Kowula. Are you sure? Yes.
All right.
Well, thanks, everybody. It was good chatting with you. Unfortunately, I have to run off here for now, but we'll definitely be back tomorrow and Thursday this week to continue the discussion. Thanks a lot. Dave, I will talk to you later, buddy.
Perfect. Thanks for joining us there, Clint. Appreciate the hour of your time there.
Awesome.
All right. I'm sharing my screen, but I don't know which screen I'm actually sharing. Looks like I'm sharing the right screen. Can you guys see my Storage Spaces slide? I think so. See if I can actually advance the slide. Perfect. All right. So another thing that we can do is, my screen's not formatted correct. Why is my screen not formatted correct? I see that too. I see that on your audience view. let me try just doing something a little different here. Let's cancel it over here. And I wonder if I can change the size in my slideshow. Give me 2 seconds here, guys. That looks okay. No, that's still cut off. All right, give me a sec. This is what happens when you have to pass the baton. Pause my screen sharing. Share with screen. And this is where everything was kind of hanging up on me. Give me a sec. Now I gotta wait for my GoToMeeting to kind of wake up. Come on. While I'm waiting for my technical difficulties to be worked out with my machine being slow, does anybody have any questions? Yes, Chad, I should call the help desk, absolutely. Let's take monitor number 3. Is that better, guys? Can you see the whole thing, or is it still acting up on us? That looks a little bit better. I did it, and I didn't even have to call the help desk, guys. Perfect. Now I'm at the beginning slide, so let me just fix this. Scroll down. I do actually know what I'm doing here, so just bear with me. There we go. That's the one we want. Perfect. Now it's showing the wrong screen. Silly screen. It's back to being cut off again. Come on now. All right, well, we're just going to deal with that. Whatever. All right, so guys, one of the things that that a lot of you probably are not aware of, and it's actually very popular from a Hyper-V configuration standpoint, is actually running your Hyper-V virtual machines over SMB3. Now, this has a number of very, very big benefits in taking and running your Hyper-V VMs over the network. And it's actually one of Microsoft's larger architecture designs where they'll run what's called a scale-out file server or a soft server at the top end. And they'll take and attach their storage pools to that and what would now be equivalent in Server 2016 storage spaces direct. One of the other big vendors that's out there today that runs their VMs in a similar fashion is Nutanix. So Nutanix actually runs pretty much all of their VMs over SMB3 attached to their hyperconverged storage framework for Hyper-V. So you don't see a huge performance loss on this, but you just want to make sure that you isolate that SMB3 network so that you have enough bandwidth to actually run it. It's pretty cool, though, for being able to transition cross-hardware vendors in doing this, because what happens is your actual storage fabric under the covers becomes very, very transparent. So this is actually fully supported. When you guys go to build a Hyper-V virtual machine, as long as you have a network share and you have the correct rights that are set up, you can actually attach that VM to a path like /// server A /prod VMs and then your VM name, and you can actually completely run it over the network like that. So I think you can kind of get the drift as to how easy that makes your infrastructure to manage if you take and if you use that. Now, I know most aren't right now, but it is a feature of Hyper-V and it is fully available for you guys today. All right, this is just connection to some of the storage providers, storage tiers. That stuff's all good. Okay, so VMM, if this is what you want to do in your builds, you want to use this scale-out file server methodology to take and to store all of your virtual machines and you want to have that kind of abstracted layer on top and you want to run everything over UNCPath, Virtual Machine Manager is very cool because you can actually deploy scale-out file server hosts right from VMM for part of your fabric. Or you could just build them manually. You could just build out a set of clustered file servers and you could just create the shares that way. So pretty cool. And these are just some additional piece of functionality that you guys may or may not have known were possible. And you can see your pools inside of there from VMM. All good. You have different tiers of storage that you have inside of there, gold and silver through VMM. And take and do some quality of service inside of there as well. So one of the big feature enhancements with 2012 R2 is the ability to take and to have some limited quality of service capabilities. Server 2016 is introducing a full rich policy-based storage quality of service capability for us. So now we can actually do some IOP limitations for those VMs under the covers. Having some different tiers inside of there and providing that back to the framework. All right. Data protection. This is a really interesting one, guys, because depending on your environments that you guys are running, you may actually have, especially if you're in healthcare, have requirements to have encrypting drives to store all your data on or have the ability to encrypt those drives. Now, Microsoft does support and have built-in support for BitLocker, but it's only for the data that's going to take and reside. And there are some issues in 2012 R2 with running BitLocker on like CSV volumes and stuff like that. So this can provide some interesting challenges for us. And Microsoft's answer to this was having the ability to run BitLocker inside of a virtual machine. And so this previously wasn't possible before Server 2016. So if you're going to stay on Server 2012 R2, working with drive encryption and stuff like that is it's a little bit challenging. In Server 2016, what Microsoft has done is they've introduced a new concept for us called a shielded virtual machine or shielded VM. And I put that into the chat window for you in case you guys are interested in this. And basically how Microsoft has done this is they've had an extension to the Hyper-V HAL and they've added something called a VTPM or Trusted Platform Module Chip. And so it's a virtualized TPM chip that can now be installed into a Hyper-V guest. Because we can have a virtual TPM chip installed inside of a Hyper-V guest, it allows me to do stuff like running BitLocker inside of the actual guest virtual machine itself. And so if you don't have the right crypto keys to open or run that particular virtual machine, what will end up happening is that VM actually becomes useless to you. Because today, this is what's going to happen inside of your data center. And it's no different with your VMDK files on VMware or Hyper-V. If somebody has physical host level access to your data center and they get the ability to take and copy files on or off, basically those raw VHDX files are fully mountable in pretty much any subsystem. So if somebody gained access to your data center and they grabbed all your VHDX files, they can in theory rebuild all of your infrastructure, run password cracking tools against them. They can do a lot of really not nice things to your infrastructure. So this new feature with shielded VMs that Microsoft came up with in 2016 is pretty huge from that aspect. Now, like anything, it requires a bit of underlying infrastructure. You need some certificate infrastructure set up to actually run it properly. But that being said, it's definitely going to be something that you're going to want to put on your radar because Microsoft is throwing a lot of investment into this. And where it becomes important for you is let's say that you've got some type of a hybrid use scenario where you want to run some of your infrastructure in your data center. And you want to run some of your infrastructure up in Amazon or Azure or something like that. Now I can actually fully secure that VM so nobody can just steal it from you. All right. Cool stuff. Right. Some BitLocker stuff. I think I got a network section coming up. Awesome. Okay, so the next section that we're going to talk about here, and Carl actually has a question for the group here, and it's, has anyone enabled the dedupe built into Windows Server 2012 R2? For example, R2 cluster with CSV plus dedupe. So Carl, in order to take and to use that in a supported fashion, you actually had to enable that functionality sitting on top of a scale-out file server cluster sitting on top for the CSV volumes themselves. So that has always been a little bit of a challenge. And the only technical supported workload that we've had for dedupe and running Windows VMs is actually VDI scenarios. The other ones like Exchange, SQL, some of those other pieces, according technically to the Microsoft platform and product teams, those actually aren't supported. Now, that being said, I've done lots of things inside of the Microsoft space for years that have been non-supported. For example, virtualizing Exchange. The actual support for virtualizing Exchange didn't come out until, you know, versions of 2007 or 2010 because Microsoft said it wasn't supported. Tons of people still did it. And I actually have some customers running in prod on just standalone volumes, non-CSVs for their environment, for some of their prod VMs, and they haven't had huge issues. The only really big thing with dedupe, if you guys are going to look at this, is you have to really watch the size of your files, because the dedupe engine in 2012 R2 can only handle 1 terabyte volumes, 1 terabyte files. And if you want to get larger than 1 terabyte files, you have to pre-format your volume with this switch, because sometimes I'll use dedupe volumes for some of my Veeam backup repositories or just general backup repositories. And it's like this, it's format your drive, and then it's a slash L switch. And if you guys aren't familiar with the format slash L switch, that labels large file blocks on that NTFS volume. And so that's what you have to pre-format that volume at if you want to take a look at having larger size files on there, because in theory it is possible for a VHD or VHDX file to grow larger than 1 terabyte in size, and that would cause you problems on a dedupe space. So before you get started on this, just do some research around it and make sure that you're actually formatting those volumes up properly, because if you don't do that, like I've done it several times, and forget to format the volume properly, your fix for that is copying all your data off, formatting the volume, and copying all your data back. So a glorified time-wasting exercise, to say the least. All right, so we've got about 20 minutes left in this session, so let's go ahead and let's cover some of our Hyper-V host and networking capabilities here. All right. Now, pretty much all of the customers that that I work with on a daily basis are using Windows Server 2012 R2, and they're using the native in-box network teaming drivers that come from Microsoft. Now, I have had a few of my customers in the past go the traditional approach, which is what you do on 2008 R2, and if you didn't know any better and nobody told you, they loaded the BASP drivers for Broadcom or the Intel teaming drivers. That is a big no-no, folks. Do not do that. Do not load the vendor teaming drivers, because Microsoft doesn't support that. Microsoft does support fully their LBFO, which is their teaming drivers, and their multiplexer drivers, and they actually support cross-vendor as well. So you want to make sure that you use those native inbox ones. Most of the customers that I work with have seen the PowerShell script that I use to configure this in one way, shape, or form, and I have been using that all the way since 2012. And it's been very successful, very stable for all of my customers across the deck, okay? So basically what you have is you've got your operating system that is going to take and build those for you. And there are a couple of different modes that you can take and that you can run. when you take and you build those Windows teams. There is a mode inside of there called switch dependent and switch independent. And there's also a third node in there for LACP. So if you do want to do some Ether channel bonding at the switch level, you can set it up there. And yeah, those are just pull down choices when you create those teaming drivers. Second one is there's another pull down inside that configuration where you can take and work based on the traffic distribution methods, where you can have an address hash, a Hyper-V switch port, or something called dynamic load balancing. How Microsoft configures these algorithms is through what's called a quad tuple or four tuple load balancing algorithm. And what that means is it's going to base that traffic load balancing based on your source and destination MAC address and your source and destination IP address, thus the kind of quad tuple methodology in behind the scenes. The dynamic load balancing is something new that came for server 2012 R2, and it's actually a combination of the Hyper-V switch port and the address hashing. So those had limited piece of functionality. They did work for 2012. So I see a lot of questions coming up either in the forums or in the NetNIC configurations. They say, well, in 2012, we used to configure with Hyper-V switch port if we were configuring for Hyper-V, and if they were just like physical SQL servers, we'd use address hashing. So the new norm is to always use dynamic load balancing because it's a combination of those two, and it'll just figure out what it needs to do under the covers. So any of the guidance that you'll see from Microsoft Consulting Services or any of those documents that you'll see for Hyper-V designs, always say to use dynamic. And don't worry, it's the default, but if you're wondering what those other options are in there, they're just for legacy configurations. All right. Just showing some traffic flow and redirections here. All right. I don't know if you guys can actually see all of this on yours. I don't think you can. I do apologize for the slides being somewhat cut off here. I will share the slides and everything with you guys. There are three types of Hyper-V host networks that you have. The three types of Hyper-V host networks that you have are going to be an external, where we actually connect our external network directly into our, what happens with our external network is that'll connect directly into our physical network, okay? And then the next type that we have, and on this external network, we can actually configure VLANs and stuff like that and whatever we need to connect into for the outside world. The next one is gonna be connecting in through, is gonna be an internal network. And an internal Hyper-V network is going to allow traffic from our virtual machines to our virtual machines to our hosts in kind of a loopback fashion. So for example, if I wanted to copy files into my guests directly from my my server itself, that Hyper-V host server, I could use an internal network adapter. And private would be if you're just building like a lab environment internally, those private networks and Hyper-V switches that you can create are going to be just for that, like an internal network that you, that you'll take and that you'll create under the covers. Okay. So there are some additional options that you have. And I don't actually know that, you know, a lot of the people that are on the call, at least my customers, if we've actually really ever gotten into this topic. And this topic is something called the Hyper-V extensible virtual switch. So basically, the Hyper-V switch that comes as part of the core kernel is basically a layer two switch. There's no routing capabilities. There's very limited capabilities in there for creating access lists and stuff like that. I can't take and do a lot of fancy things. Like I can do some very basic port mirroring, but it doesn't have the same level of connectivity that we would have, for example, in your Cisco infrastructure, your Cisco Nexus infrastructure, and so on. So you can actually replace that Hyper-V virtual switch if you wanted to. You can actually replace it with a Cisco iOS-driven switch. so that you don't have to take and use the default one that's in there by that Hyper-V gives you. Now, I don't have a lot of customers personally that are doing that with completely replacing that switch, but just understand that it is possible. So if your network team really wants to take that over, and this was a competitive feature that Microsoft put in to compete with a lot of the software-defined networking capabilities that VMware would give us, and that's what Microsoft's answer to that was, to say, okay, fine, you can have an extensible virtual switch. If you don't like ours, just go ahead and replace it. And the functionality is there, but then, you know, you can't manage that anymore through the typical native Hyper-V management tools or UI. Switch is very stable. I've never really had issues with the switch going up and down or flapping and doing that kind of stuff. So that's never really been a big problem for me. All right. So layer two switches. So some of the capabilities and some of the options that we have inside of here for the native Hyper-V switch is it does have capabilities for isolated private VLANing, DHCP guard. You can take and you can trunk to directly to VMs. You can do port mirroring, and you can use PowerShell to manage it. Now, one of the vendors that I do a lot of work with is a company called Five9 Software. And what Five9 Software does is they actually integrate directly into the Hyper-V extensible virtual switch. And that Hyper-V extensible virtual switch is actually used to take and to run some advanced network security and protection capabilities for your virtual machines, virtual infrastructure, your antivirus, and so on. And so, for example, one of the things that they do is they add an IDS, or intrusion detection module, inside of that extensible virtual switch. And that's actually licensed from Cisco Snort. So basically, that's one of the things that just a vendor that's out there has done. And so some of those extensions that vendors can tap into are, you know, extension protocols, capturing, filtering, forwarding, so on. And they've actually built in their own full-featured firewall into there as well. So I can have VM to VM firewall capabilities built right into that extensible virtual switch at a software level. So just kind of an example as to, you know, one vendor that I know that's doing a lot of work inside of there. And so we can see that there's Five9, Cisco's got their Nexus V, NEC, InMotion. There's a few more that aren't even listed inside of there as well. And I'll share the deck with you guys so you can see that afterwards as well. Just some of the capabilities between your VMware environments and your Hyper-V environments, you know, integrated NIC teaming, sure, spoofing, all that stuff. Okay, so this is a piece that you guys have probably, if Microsoft has been on site to your organization, they've probably talked to you guys about the software-defined capabilities that you have with System Center Virtual Machine Manager. So I want you guys to understand that there's a big differentiator between running the native management tools and taking and running System Center Virtual Machine Manager. And the biggest one to me, in my opinion, is the changes inside of the network stack when you use Virtual Machine Manager. So for example, what you can see on your screen right now is you can see a blue network and a red network. Well, there's a problem with the blue network and the red network. The blue network and the red network are both running on the same IP scheme. You can't do this. So what we have to take and do is we have to have some network isolation inside of there. And so basically what this is called from Microsoft is network virtualization, GRE. So NVGRE is the actual term for this. And so what happens is that with VMM running on top of your Hyper-V infrastructure and NVGRE, or the network virtualization components enabled, what you can do is you can adjust the preamble packets that are sent, for example, on blue virtual machines, so that they always know to go to that path. So it's actually adjusted in flight as the packets are flowing through your virtual environment in the virtual network stack, and we can actually have overlapping IP spaces. Now, what you guys can think of in your worlds is this would be extremely advantageous if you were going through a merger and an acquisition phase, because you might want to bring in all of that underlying infrastructure that's sitting out there for the organization that you've just acquired or been acquired by. Now what you can do with network virtualization is you can actually just seamlessly bring that right into your Hyper-V and System Center Virtual Machine Manager environment, and you can run both in parallel because it's just adjusting those preamble packets at the front of all of the traffic that's going through, and it knows which side it's supposed to flow on. So company A could be here, company B could be on the other side. So it's pretty cool. And, you know, when you start looking at some of the advanced features that you have, that's one of them is the network virtualization. One of the other really big ones is IP pool management and integration with your IPAM solutions. How often have you guys run into a situation where you're hunting for the next available IP address for this particular server? You know, I run into it all the time. I had it happen to me last week. Hey, I got to spin up a VM. Where's the IP spreadsheet? You know, I don't know which one to go pick, and I'm not sure which one to go assign to this particular server. VMM can auto-assign those IP addresses for you. So that is also very cool. Second thing is all of my scripts that I'll take and I'll run through PowerShell for the manual configuration of the particular Hyper-V hosts, those ones there are going to take and those ones there are going to be can be automated through VMM via network management and framework templates. And it saves a lot of trouble because then as you bring on new virtual hosts, I don't have to take and worry about going through and doing, you know, manual script configurations and stuff like that. You can also take and add in your network load balancer automation inside of there. And the next biggest one is you can integrate something called service templates. So for example, many of you in your organizations today would run, you know, larger SharePoint deployments. And so with those larger SharePoint deployments, you would have to take and spin up that farm. So included in that farm would be basically three tiers. There would be a SQL tier, there'd be an app tier, there'd be a web tier. So what you can do with VMM is you can take and you can actually have those tiers being built out systematically for you, as well as downloading all of those available additional templates for the things that you want to do in your infrastructure. Now, do you have to use all these features? The answer is absolutely not. Can you just use the raw functionality inside a virtual machine manager with just, you know, creating VMs, getting a single pane of glass, doing those pieces? Yes. Go back to your 80-20 rule, folks. What you're going to have is you're going to have 80% of the core functionality that you really care about. The extra 20% is gravy. 99% of the people that are out there today aren't even going to use any of this additional functionality. In fact, I have very, very few customers that have actually implemented network virtualization today. It is a very cool concept. It is a very cool idea from Microsoft. But the thing is that it adds a lot of additional complexity as well. So you have to understand, you know, what some of those trade-offs are going to look like. So the glossy footprint is that if you have somebody from Microsoft coming in and they're talking to you about these pieces and you should implement all these, fact of the matter is that a lot of people get away with not even having to worry about them. But just understand that they're there and that they're available for you. It's part of the product set that that you have purchased. All right. So some of the things that you can take and that you can integrate with top-of-rack switches, that's fine. This was just the logical network controls through the abstraction of the NVGRE that I was just talking about for your infrastructure. And then the creation of kind of your logical networks that you see under the covers. And I think what we're going to do is we have another session that's coming up tomorrow. It's about an hour and 26 minutes that we've gone here so far. I'll leave it open for about 5 minutes of just general Q&A. If you guys want, we can just have a chat around anything that you want in here. Just unmute your mic, and if you guys want, you can fire away. If you have to take off, you guys, I do thank you for jumping in with us here today. I will have these recordings. I'll put them up and available for everyone on a shared OneDrive location. And so if you guys have any questions, fire away. I'll be hanging out here for about another 5 minutes or so. new questions, somebody's got to have a question. I'll bring coffee into your team if somebody asks a question. Okay, I guess I owe Scott a pot of coffee now. Funny guys. Well, if you guys don't have any questions, it's cool. Save your questions for tomorrow. We're going to be running these sessions. I got two more running this week, and we'll probably be running the same type of stuff next week and the week after as we take and go through this. Like I said, if you do have to miss this for work-related reasons or whatever it is, don't worry too much about it, because I'll have all the recordings up in a central location. So if you need to catch up, you can. And hopefully everybody enjoyed the first part of this. The next batches that we have going through, after we go through the kind of base overview like we're doing in the first two sessions here, start to get into some new demos and stuff like that. So, all right, thanks guys. I'm just gonna stop the recording here.